Good morning, everyone. I want to open the April 23rd, 2015 meeting of the House Ag and Natural Resources Committee. Absent a gavel, it worked for Khrushchev, so we're we are convened. Today's agenda, we're going to have an informational hearing on the wine industry and the many, many contributions that makes to agriculture in the state, our state's economy, and the general well-being, health and welfare of the populace. So with that, welcome to our committee. Thank you so much for making yourselves available for this hearing, and please decide among yourselves the order of your testimony.
Well, we're ready to start, and thank you,
please,
Chairman Khrushchev. That was a great opening, and thank you very much again for the invitation and the opportunity to tell you about what we think is an absolutely tremendous contributor to the Oregon economy, and that's our wine and grape growing businesses around the state. We heard a couple of days ago that there was an opportunity to come and speak to you, and we took advantage of it. So what we want to do, first of all, is be responsive to the request for an overview of the business. There have been a lot of changes, perhaps, since the last time you had took a deep dive into the Oregon wine business and the grape-growing sector of our economy. We're going to talk a little bit about that. And then we also want to make sure that we're touching on an issue that's very relevant to this committee, as it is to many growers around the state, which is the issue of spray drift. We'll talk a little bit about that as well. We're here today representing the state's 605 wineries and 950 growers around the state. We're also I'm also joined today by a few of my colleagues that I want to make sure to introduce from the Oregon Wine Board. Marie Chambers is with me right here, and also from the Oregon Wine Growers Association, I'm joined by Jana McCamey, and you'll hear from both of those organizations. Dan Jarman, Ellen Miller, and Tess Milio are with us as well, and I also want to make sure to acknowledge our Board of Directors member, Doug Tinnell, founder and owner of Brickhouse Vineyards in the Ribbon Ridge area, not far from the Dundee Hills, and you'll be hearing from most of those people, not all. We've only got 2 hours, but I'm reminded that I should give my name for the record. It's Tom Donowski. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Wine Board and the Oregon Wine Growers Association. You might be wondering why there are two logos on that screen. You'll be hearing from both of our organizations today. Doug happens to be a board member of both of them. They have a very special inner relationship, although they are totally distinct and separate. We'll touch on that a little bit, but they have a very special inner relationship. Each is responsible for advancing different parts of the Oregon wine industry's growth agenda. We'll talk a little bit about that as we go forward. And I'll go through these fairly briskly, but I'm happy to stop and elaborate when it's helpful. About 12 years ago, the state recognized that there was an opportunity to create a little more focused and disciplined mechanism for marketing and promoting and providing research funding to the Oregon wine industry. That's where the Oregon Wine Board came from. And our purposes are primarily around marketing promotion and research, specifically grape growing and winemaking research. Those are the two primary areas that the Wine Board focuses on. To give you a little bit of a sense of how we are funded, the industry pays for what we do. At the Oregon Wine Board, the OLCC collects tax from growers and wineries, and 82% of our Oregon Wine Board funding comes from a tax on every ton of grapes grown and crushed here in Oregon. The privilege tax that you might have heard about, of course, collected by OLCC, that is a relatively smaller part of our budget. The graphic on the right gives you that in dollar terms. I know as I travel around the state, there is sometimes a little bit of a misconception about how much of that privilege tax collected by the OLCC gets to the wine board. I've heard people say, well, don't you get 10 or 15 or 20%? No, in fact, we get far less than 1% of that funding. The wine board and its activities are funded by the industry. Our board of directors is governor appointed. And these are all volunteers, Doug included. They give up their time for committee service and board service. They serve 3-year terms. As you can tell from the column on the right, they represent a good cross-section of geographic diversity. They also represent a good cross-section of both vineyard interests and winery interests. And they also represent various sizes and scales of operations. I'll let you read that, but it's the best picture we have in the whole presentation, so I'll let you linger over. We're at a really powerful and profound inflection point right now with the Oregon wine business. As I mentioned in the very end of this statement right here, you might have seen in your newspapers, there's a tremendous inflow of capital from around the world, not just California or Washington State that has invested here recently, but Europe. Oregon is enjoying a position in the industry spotlight, probably unlike anything it has ever had in the six decades that it has sort of been in its modern wine growing era. The Oregon wine business actually goes back over 100 years when Peter Britt first started planting vineyards in southern Oregon. But sort of the modern era really began in the early 60s when Richard Summers planted Pinot Noir in southern Oregon. And in fact, coincidentally, the Willamette Valley is celebrating this year its 50th anniversary of the first planting of its Pinot Noir vines. So some important milestones. But over the last probably 5 to 10 years, there has been an increasing spotlight shining on Oregon, and we're going to talk about why that is. You can see the growth in the number of wineries, and this is a statewide phenomenon. But what's important is what is underlying some of that trend data. What you've got in the colored areas of all these slides are all of the different federally recognized American viticultural areas, AVAs. They are areas that are recognized by the Department of Treasury's Tobacco and Trade Tax Bureau as having distinct soil profiles, distinct topography, distinct weather patterns that make them unique, and they are recognized as such, allowing winemakers to put individual regional names on wine labels. Those are called AVAs. Oregon now has 18 of them. In fact, there was some great press just a couple of weeks ago when our most recent vit area was recognized by the federal government over in the Milton Freewater area. It's called the Rocks District of Milton Freewater. These continue to be important signals to the consumer of quality when grapes can be identified by region. And they're a big part of the branding story for Oregon wine. The data here ends on 2013. We have not yet finalized all of our 2014 data, but I did want to give you a 10-year snapshot of what has happened in the wine business since the Oregon Wine Board was founded in 2003. And again, these really just continue to make the points about tremendous growth, both in planted acreage, number of wineries, number of vineyards. What it masks, however, is a couple of things I'm going to come back to later, but one of the questions that we get very often is, how does our business compare in size, scope, and scale to that of Washington State? And this answers that question for you. You can see we're fairly comparable in number of wineries. Their tonnage is significantly, almost 4x greater than ours, and their production is significantly higher, driven primarily by the brands at Chateau Ste. Michel, which by itself is twice as big as our entire industry. In fact, Chateau Ste. Michel owns the Erath Winery here in Oregon, and they've been very, very supportive and a great partner as we develop the Oregon story. We're going to talk a little bit about economic impact, but it is interesting to have a comparison of our business versus Washington. I talked a little bit about the number of vineyards and the number of wineries that we have. What that masks is a really important aspect of our business that's highlighted here in blue on this graph. The 71% of the state's wineries that are producing relatively small amounts, 5,000 cases or less. And that really is a great opportunity to bring you in if you maybe have experienced it yourself as you visited wine regions around the state. This is an industry made up primarily, overwhelmingly, in fact, by mid-sized to small family-run businesses and farmers. And that is easy to forget. You turn on the TV or you go out to wine country and you will see some absolutely stunning estates And Oregon has its fair share of those. That's a very, very small part of the business. For those who think that we sit on our side of the table and swirl, sniff, and spit all day, there's more to it than that, because we serve a community that is working extremely hard, and they're small family-run businesses. This is an important number because it's not widely known that almost three-quarters of the business is made up of these small family-run operations. One of the questions we often get is, how does our business and our production skew geographically? And this answers that question for you. North Willamette Valley is primarily Yamhill County. Rogue, of course, Jackson and Josephine. South Willamette is a rapidly growing area, as is Umpqua. You heard me talk a couple minutes ago about the Milton Free Water District. We continue to see tremendous acceleration in new vineyard plantings, both in the northeastern corner of Oregon and in the southern part of Oregon. One of the questions we often get is Oregon only Pinot Noir? While Pinot Noir has been the tip of the spear and is almost always the first thing that consumers think of when they think of Oregon, and will be, I'm sure, for some time, there are several important varieties that continue to have their share of notoriety and continue to get their share of great scores. Let me stop for a minute, see if I'm prompting any questions or thoughts.
Committee members?
Please.
Chair, just a technical question. When you look at the difference between a Willamette Valley vineyard and a Milton Freewater vineyard, what are the irrigation challenges? Are there irrigation challenges in different geographic areas of the state?
You know, that's an excellent point. It reminds me to kind of back up a little bit. While we do have, as I mentioned, 18 different areas in the state that are designated as AVAs, we have probably more diversity in our vineyard composition mix around the state probably than almost any growing region in the world. Specifically to your question, most of the vineyards that are going in the Milton Freewater area are going in with water rights, but you're forecasting an issue that this industry and every wine growing district up and down the West Coast is going to have to deal with, which is much more intelligent and thoughtful uses of water. In eastern Oregon and in southern Oregon, we will confront those challenges probably sooner than later. It's one of the reasons why the Wine Board continues to invest industry research dollars to try to help our growers deal with water stress. Mm-hmm. While some water stress is sort of ironically good for the vines in that it forces the vine to focus on fruit production, too much water stress at the wrong time can be a real problem. But not sure if I'm speaking to your question, but it is an area that we're very well aware of in southern and eastern
Oregon. So. I follow up. The different varieties, I'm sure, have different needs. It's just intriguing to think about the difference between here and there in southern Oregon. You're right. The diversity is stunning, but it's what makes it a great state.
And well said.
It may be what produces a great variety of wonderful wine coming from here, which is all good. It was just a curiosity. So thank
well
you.
Well said. Thank
Representative
you.
Barreto, I think you may have had something as well.
I did. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And previous to this, you had a map of Oregon with some color-coded areas, and didn't have anything on the legend. I was just wondering what those color codes
determine. Sure. I'm happy to back up, if you'll indulge me a second. And we have copies for the committee of that
graphic. Right there.
Color-coded areas are indicating American viticultural areas. There are 18 of them around the state. So the colored areas are those areas that have been recognized.
So there's no the different colors don't designate so much production or better or worse?
No, they don't. And that's a great question. Thank you, Representative Barreto. It reminds me that some of the information, I probably flew by it pretty quickly, but this is all available. The information on production by region is here. But that map, and I'm happy to give you my copy and send all members of the committee a copy of it, are just indicating the actual geographic areas. Again, as a way of showing the breadth of grape growing up and down the I-5 corridor and that I-84 corridor all the way over to Milton Freewater.
And before you proceed, I also want to make it clear to not only this panel but anyone else who will be speaking today, as the House Ag and Natural Resources Committee, this is a two-way street. So while you're presenting information, If you think of things that we as a state ought to be doing, ought to be considering in terms of helping to facilitate the growth of your industry and the promotion of your product, please feel free, as appropriate, to let us know.
Thank you for that invitation, Chairman Wick. We do have a 15-page list of things that we'd share.
We'd love to see it.
In fact, speaking to that invitation and also to Representative McCune's comment about irrigation and water stress, one of the areas where research will, specifically technical research, done largely in partnership with our friends at Oregon State University and the Oregon Wine Research Institute, our industry and our growers are wholeheartedly in support of the request that's been made by Oregon State University for their funding, specifically involving fermentation sciences funding. That will drive research that will allow us to be much more thoughtful and intelligent about dealing with the scarce water resource that we're confronting.
Thank you very much. Committee members, please take note.
Made it last time.
Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're embarking and looking into the WISE project down in southern Oregon, where we're going to put culverts and close our irrigation system because we're losing about a third of our water from point A to point B. The other thing we have coming up that we have to watch very closely is we have adjudicated rights of water that's coming in from the Klamath side, and now there's been some talk of some litigation to not allow us to bring that water in due to the salmon run in the lower Klamath River, so by the tribe in Klamath Falls. So it's kind of like we don't know where we're going to be in 10 years. So it would be disastrous to our agricultural community if we lose those rights.
Well, that's very well said, especially in an area of southern Oregon where we continue to see dramatic acceleration in vineyard plantings and new innovation. In fact, for some who may not be aware, one of the state's primary institutes for research and education, in addition to Oregon State, is the Southern Oregon Wine Institute on the campus of Umpqua Community College in Roseburg. And they continue to drive a lot of innovation and thoughtful thinking around the Southern Oregon viticulture needs, specifically around irrigation.
Yeah, we're very blessed. We have a belt. We call it the belt, and it's around the valley, and it's a certain altitude that grows extremely well with vineyards. Mm. And then out in the Applegate Valley as well.
Thank you. I should probably press forward here.
Please.
We've got a little more material to share with you. This is an exhibit. I'm going to shift now to give you a little bit of insight into the marketplace that our wineries compete in, because it is it's a challenging environment, as I'm sure you've noticed. If you've ever stood in front of a wine shelf, you've probably seen an array of brands that is almost staggering. In fact, what it illustrates is something really interesting. As our state's economy continues to sort of rebalance away from what has historically been natural resource extraction, we're entering an area where these categories like wine, consumer-facing, premium-priced, tourism-driving ag sectors have a chance to really help reposition Oregon in a really profound way. And we have a tremendous opportunity right now, if we care and nurture these businesses, one of them, of course, is the wine business, to really make a statement about Oregon that others in the world and certainly in this country will learn from, about how thoughtfully we can grow an industry that has a multiplier effect across so many sectors of our economy. What this is showing you is how the wine sales break out in the wine category by price point. We've listed price points along the far left side and giving you the percentage of dollar volume that is done in those price points. So on the far lower left-hand corner, you can see that wines of $8 or less currently represent a little bit over half of the wine category volume. I should say this is not just Oregon. This is the wine category as reported by Nielsen, which although a very good measure of store sales, it unfortunately doesn't capture what for us is about a 40% sector of our business, primarily done through restaurants and hotels and resorts. But as an indicator of what the consumer chooses to do in the freedom of choice environment of a grocery store kind of environment, Nielsen is an indicative metric. So what this can show you is the way the different price points break out. What's very, very interesting and illustrative of the dynamics we deal with is when you compare Oregon's wine volume to the national averages. You can see a significantly higher proportion of Oregon's volume is done at higher price points. And the farmers that are growing wine grapes and the winemakers that are crushing those grapes are dealing with relatively low yields here in Oregon. We farm at the margin. Many of these vineyards, as was just mentioned by Representative Esquivel, are at altitude. Many of them encounter cooler weather, and the fruit struggles to get maybe to full ripeness, unlike our colleagues in California. The cost of farming here is higher than it is for many of our colleagues in other regions making wine grapes. That dictates a different set of economics. The other really, really important aspect that I'll touch on in just a minute is the quality of Oregon wine has risen and accelerated to the point where the demand at those price points is firm. And that makes all the difference. Creating demand in the marketplace is one of the most difficult things a winemaker does. When you have it, you do not want to lose it. But consumers are willing to pay the prices required for quality. So this is very important. Oregon wines compete in that upper end, excuse me, of the tier. Now here's a humbling slide illustrating our market share versus California and Washington.
Oh, my.
Wow.
Again, I should make very clear that this data is from Nielsen. It is tracking what's called the off-premise sector, which is all the stores and all the environments where a consumer will buy wine but not consume it where they've bought it. It's in contrast to the on-premise segment, restaurants and resorts. Consumer pays and consumes wine at the same place. So these Nielsen numbers are, again, illustrative, but they are very important. It's one of the reasons why we call Oregon a region of discovery. When you're a 1% market share, that's exactly what you are. But we are overrepresented, again, in those upper price points where the fine wine buyers congregate. You can see our average bottle price, reinforcing what I just said just a few minutes ago. But more importantly, in the far right side at the bottom, you can see our growth trend. I should also make a point that the data that I'm sharing today does not include much analysis, just to keep it focused, it does not include much analysis of the 6% of Oregon wine that goes to international markets. I'm talking about our domestic markets here when I present this data. I want to give you a little bit of insight into what winemakers are dealing with respect to getting to the marketplace. They go to market through wholesalers called distributors. Those distributors have sales organizations in different cities that call on restaurants and fine wine accounts. Winemakers like Doug will sell to a distributor who in turn will take it to all the restaurants and all the accounts in that city. What our wineries are dealing with is a tremendous consolidation of the wholesale channel. It's almost like an hourglass. There are over 8,100 wineries, over 8,100 wineries in America. That is more than double the number of microbreweries in America. And we could start a microbrewery pretty much in the back of a pickup truck. There's very low barriers to entry. So you'd think they'd be comparable. There is a tremendous number of wineries trying to get through these channels, and these channels are consolidating and shrinking. So it's one of the reasons why I'll talk in just a minute about the importance of supporting efforts to drive more tourism and direct-to-consumer business in the tasting room for these wineries. But a large part of the business is going through distributors, and as you can see in the bottom line of this slide, the distributor channel has consolidated from over 3,000 20 years ago to a little less than a quarter of that now. So we're very fortunate that Oregon is in a spotlight, as I said, and is really a region that distributors want to have. But winemakers work very, very hard to find the right distributor and to have that distributor grow their brand in the markets around the country. one of the primary downsides, if there is, of having high price points is that your availability and your distribution can be somewhat limited. Not every single store has shoppers willing to pay $15 for a bottle of wine when a $6 alternative is available. There are those that do, and they are continuing to expand. But as you can see, as Oregon continues to push into more distribution, we have a lot of upside to grow more points of availability for our wines. And that's a primary focus of the Wine Board's marketing and promotion activity, is getting more distributors to carry more Oregon wines and penetrate the market to its full potential. Let me stop there for a second before we kind of move into the last phase of our Oregon Wine Board discussion.
Committee members?
Actually, I
Representative Gorsuch.
In terms of all of those numbers and Oregon's small share, do you think the potential is there for this market to eventually be saturated? I mean, there's a lot of wineries that have come online. How many more do you think there's room for in the state?
You know, that's a great question, but the answer is no. I don't think it's saturated, provided that we can continue to drive what is becoming a key reputational asset for Oregon, which is quality. It's unlikely that Oregon will ever be an area where cost of goods will be a significant advantage. As I said, the farming dynamics here in Oregon and the weather dynamics, they create an economic profile that tends to push our wines up. It's difficult to foresee in the near term that changing. It makes quality an absolutely critical imperative, and we're extremely fortunate that that ethic cuts across every geography in this state. There is not a winemaker in this state that isn't focused on quality. But I don't think it's saturated at all. Okay. It's one of the reasons, as I said, why we continue to see investment in this state from Europe, from Washington State, from California. These are very smart people who have studied the wine business for decades. When they plant their vineyards here, when they invest capital, it is because they see growth potential, and so does pretty much everybody in the business. It is, again, another reinforcement of continuing to drive quality through research funding, and I mentioned the fermentation sciences before, but it's an excellent question, but I have to say no, I don't see a saturation point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Vice Chair McLean, followed by Representative McEwen.
You indicated that in just sort of passing comments, that you had like 6% of an international part of your industry, and you talk about quality and the ability to, you know, have higher wine costs for consumers. And so are you growing that part of, I mean, how do you connect the domestic and the international and deal with those quality issues? And I didn't understand why this was just domestic that you were talking about today.
Sure. It's a great question. Thank you, Representative McLean. We thought, for purposes of this overview, the 94% of our sales that are represented by our domestic volume would be of primary interest.
Okay.
We're happy to come back and talk for hours about the international segment, but I will try to speak to your question. We're quite fortunate that a hunger and a demand for quality is a global phenomenon, and Oregon is satisfying it. We continue to see growth opportunities for Oregon wineries internationally. They are very market specific, where they're the conditions that set up a market well for Oregon tend to be a pretty good concentration and cluster of somewhat affluent consumers. By the time you take our high price points and add on import tariffs, there are some significant cost issues. The markets that tend to set up well for us, Toronto, London, Hong Kong, Tokyo, tend to be markets, Seoul, Korea, where markets where there are good concentrations of consumers, where there are good concentrations of restaurants capable of selling wine at those price points. As a number of our winemakers are dealing with what was a record harvest in 2013, followed by an even bigger record harvest in 2014, there is a supply imperative that is going to be opening up more opportunities to get more wines into international markets. It continues to be a very, very bright growth spot for us. as you saw in that one chart I had when I was talking about the number of distributors in this country that has so significantly reduced, narrowing the opportunity to go to market, that phenomenon is happening internationally as well. Finding the right import partner to grow your brand overseas is a 2 or 3 month process, a 2 or 3 year process sometimes. But again, all upside. I think it also ties back to Representative Gorsuch's question about saturation. It's another reason why we see no signs of saturation as far as Oregon wine.
Thank you.
Thank you for the question.
Representative McEwen.
Thank you, Chair Witt. There are those of us on the committee that pushed hard for the funding for the Fermentation Sciences Program in the last session. It would be interesting to me to know how you think that's going. Are you getting the expertise coming out of that program that's helping your industry continue to grow? What else do you need from us in regarding the Fermentation Sciences Program? And I know it's broader than just viticulture, but can you give us just a little highlight of how that's helping you?
Sure, that's an excellent question. The Fermentation Sciences Program at Oregon State, for some who might not know, is a program that benefits not only the wine business, but the breweries and the bread business and the cheese business, and all of those fermentation sciences programs are funded together and are managed by Oregon State University research scientists. Oregon wine tends to be the primary focus of the fermentation sciences activity. They have done some excellent work in helping a couple of key projects advance. One of them is what we call a crop load trial, a long-term study that will help our growers be more thoughtful and more intentional about improving their yields per acre while not sacrificing quality. The farming economics underlie just about everything that happens in this business. When you're getting 2.3 tons of fruit per acre compared to almost three times that level in California, it suggests an opportunity for us to improve farming economics. Specific to fermentation sciences, their work has largely been around sensory work, that is helping us evaluate what are the impacts on wine quality of, in intentional ways, improving the farming economics. So one of the things we're doing is sensory wine trials that allow Oregon State University researchers to assess quality levels of wines when they are farmed at different yields per acre. As those yields go up and the economics improve, we cannot sacrifice quality. That's one very important area where fermentation sciences money has made a difference.
Quick follow-up.
Please.
I see two pieces to this fermentation sciences program. I see the research being done that helps your industry thrive, but I also see the production of individuals who come out of those programs who can work in your industry on the ground. So are you seeing that piece also become beneficial to your industry?
Well, we are, and that's another aspect where both Oregon State University, Chemeketa, Umpqua Community College, all of those institutes together are creating the labor force that this industry will need as it grows. It continues to be a really important aspect of what is a key reputational asset for Oregon. Oregon is known for sustainability. And while we think about that in terms of farming practices and intelligent agriculture, it has just as much relevance to the sustainability of our workforce. So many of our businesses are multi-generational, and the second and third generation comes in and it sustains that way. But the labor force is another aspect of sustainability, and it is absolutely critical because, unlike so many other regions around the world that are producing fine wine grapes, the number of hand touches that Pinot Noir and Oregon wine grapes require during the growing season is staggering. Everything from training the vines in the winter to pruning to the actual harvesting. This is skilled labor, and that skilled labor comes from the institutes that we've talked about.
Great. So one more quick follow-up.
Absolutely.
I sit on higher ed workforce development also, so this workforce conduit intrigues me. You don't see any constraints there. You're getting what you need is what I'm hearing you say.
Well, I would say if there were an opportunity to fund continued training opportunities at Chemeketa, at Umpqua Community College, and Oregon State University, particularly in the viticulture area, in the grape growing and grape farming, I think those are areas where continued investment will, again, pay tremendous dividends for the state.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you for the question.
Representative Barreto, I wasn't sure whether I caught an attempt by you to get in the queue or not. Out of the corner of my eye.
Actually, I did have a question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the business model, and going back to what Representative Gorsuch mentioned, as far as the model is to build quality and to sell quality and to brand it that way with Oregon synonymous with quality. And then as far as growth, you know, a lot of growth since 2000. Are you continuing to see growth here in the next, say, 10 years as far as more vineyards being planted, more wineries coming up, and the investment that is coming into Oregon right now, is it because of the profitability of the branding? Is that all kind of fitting together?
That's a great set of two important questions, Representative Barreto. Do we continue to see growth? Yes, I think probably on a slightly different, and there, Doug, you may have a thought here, there are slightly different maybe geographic mix than we've seen in the past. While Oregon is a region of discovery for the consumer, it is probably a little bit less so for those in the wine business. And the reason I say that is because so many highly esteemed companies are invested here and continue to invest here. As that happens, prices go up in certain parts of the state. I think we will continue to see expansion in acreage and winemaking capacity in the Columbia Gorge, in northeastern Oregon, and in southern Oregon. While we will continue to see growth in what is ground zero for our business, the Willamette Valley, I think that will probably slow somewhat. But we will continue to see growth in new parts of the state.
With respect to the quality of Oregon's wines, I've noticed somewhat from a distance that rather than long-time producers, maybe shunning those who are trying to gain entry into the marketplace, that they are embraced, that the established producers help coach, maybe mentor those who are trying to enter the marketplace. And I can't help but think that this has in turn helped to maintain Oregon's quality of wine production as well.
Yeah, that's a great observation, Mr. Chairman. In fact, there's a very short anecdote that maybe hammers that home. About 12 years ago, there was a winemaker here in the North Willamette Valley named Jimmy Brooks, and he had a young son, and he was tragically taken from us. Jimmy was leaving behind a young boy in a business, a thriving wine business that was just starting to find traction in the marketplace. To that point, about half a dozen winemakers who had neighbored his farm and were around him came in and told the surviving members of the family, we will make Jimmy's wine for him, and we will sustain this, and we will preserve this so that in 10 years when Pascal, the 8-year-old boy, is willing to make a decision about whether he wants to continue it, he'll have that option. That was a really great example. We see those kinds of examples all the time. There is a tremendous knowledge sharing and knowledge transfer, not only from generation to generation, but from neighbor to neighbor. There are equipment sharing arrangements. In a very, very Oregon way, I think people realize that they need their neighbors, that they have far more in common than they do fighting it out amongst their brands. And it's a great observation.
It's a wonderful human interest story as well. And I just make note, Mr. Gallagher has reminded me that we are going to be having a presentation here before this committee on May 5th regarding OSU's fermentation program. So coming events, please take note.
Good. Thank you. As I'm looking at the clock, I want to make sure that I'm progressing, so I will try to pick up my pace a little bit, but please keep the questions coming. They're excellent. One of the things that we were asked to comment on very specifically is the economic impact of the wine business. There's a couple numbers I want to share with you, but they all pivot around the fact that the wine business has become a multiplier touching many sectors of the Oregon economy. This is data from 2013, our most recent economic impact study. It's statewide data. And it tallies up all the revenue and all the jobs that are touched by the Oregon wine business here in the state of Oregon. And there were a couple of really interesting observations. Total economic impact, total jobs, total tourism are all up over 25%. And for the first time that we've seen, when measured by market value, wine grapes are now the state's number one fruit crop. I want to talk just a little bit about how that multiplies out in a couple of our key sectors, specifically tourism. And you heard a little bit earlier in our conversation, I was talking about some of the challenges that our wineries face when trying to go to market through a rapidly narrowing distribution channel. That creates the imperative and a tremendous opportunity for generating more tourism traffic into those tasting rooms, allowing a winemaker or a grower to sell directly to the consumer. No intermediary mid-market players. They sell directly to that consumer. They also are able to get that consumer, in many cases, to join their wine club, such that when they return to Omaha or Orlando, that consumer is getting four shipments a year from an Oregon winery, and they can again evangelize to their friends and neighbors by sharing Oregon wine there. So tourism, driving direct-to-consumer sales, is a critical growth sector. It's one of the reasons why we've been so fortunate to have such an enthusiastic partner in the state's tourism authority, Travel Oregon, as we work together on programs to drive wine tourism from the strong tourism inflow that they generate. One of the key programs that state legislators approved and our governor signed into law about 4 years ago is the Wine Country License Plate. We are just right on the cusp now of announcing to the tourism and the wine industry the path by which they can apply for grants to use the money that this program has generated for wine tourism. The money has been accumulating, and we're at the point now where, starting in about 10 days, the tourism industry statewide and the wine industry will be able to make the grant applications for this program. It's been a tremendous success, and it's another great example of something that you will not see anywhere else in the country except here in Oregon, a wine country plate. This is a little different look at what we've been talking about here, the multiplier effect and the reputation of the Oregon wine industry. This data reflects a survey done not by the Wine Board, but by Oregon Business Magazine of almost 350 of their readers around the state. And they were asked, which industry has significantly improved Oregon's reputation? And you can see how impressive the ranking is for the Oregon wine industry. Another aspect of that same study asked not only about Oregon's reputation, but asked these same 340 people about economic impact. And again, this underscores that ripple effect, that multiplier effect of the wine business. Last couple things I want to touch on are responsive to the request for some marketplace data and information that we haven't touched on yet. We talked to over 900 consumers a couple years ago in partnership with our friends at Linfield College. They have got a couple of people on staff there that are among the best in the country at assessing not only corporate reputations, but regional and business and nonprofit reputations. We asked them to talk to about 930 consumers across the country, and we asked them questions. They were fine wine drinkers. We asked them questions about California wines, Oregon wines, Washington wines. What comes through abundantly abundantly clearly is that without prompting, the attributes and the reputational assets that Oregon is known for with respect to wine are these handcrafted artisan wines, again, small family farms, and organic, sustainably made, or intelligently farmed. I want to come back to that small family farms point because you'll remember at the top of our presentation, we talked about the fact that 71% of the wineries in this state are 5,000 cases or less. It just reinforces that this is an industry that is thriving because of the midsize and small family run operations. And that is a reputation asset that is known throughout the wine business. We've talked quite a bit about quality and why it is such an imperative. I think one of the really important ways that the wine business might differ from the businesses of some of our other colleagues in various ag sectors is we have magazines, blogs, websites, Twitter and Facebook accounts dedicated to evaluating the products publicly. With all due respect to our colleagues in the other ag sectors, I don't see magazines being published rating blueberries or strawberries or other crops on 100-point scales for the consumer to see. It's a really important part of the wine business. These wine critics and wine journalists, it's a big part of our marketing program, is bringing them here. But on the far right-hand side of this, you can see one of the benchmark publications in our business is called The Wine Spectator. And they are nationally distributed, and their ratings of a wine on a 100-point scale are very significant. They can move markets. That magazine is read by restaurateurs, fine wine shop owners, and you'd think, well, you know, these are professional winemakers. Why aren't they getting 100 out of 100? Nobody gets 100 out of 100. Chateau Latour might get that every 5 years. But when you cross that 90-point barrier on their 100-point scale, restaurateurs notice that. Fine wine shop owners notice that. Consumers walk into those fine wine shops with a ripping from the magazine saying, how do I get this wine that got a 94? It moves markets. What's really important is that at the end of 2014, the magazine Wine Spectator did a rack-up of all the 800 wines from anywhere in the world that they had given 90 points or better to over the course of the preceding several months. Oregon had 12.5% of those 90-plus rated wines. That's what's indicated on the right-hand side of this chart. Compare that to the left-hand side of the chart, which is the percentage of the world's fine wine grape acreage here in Oregon. There's probably not a more vivid example of the reputation that has been so well deserved for fine wine quality here in Oregon than that. It's an incredible coincidence that one of our pioneers in our business in the Carlton, in Yamhill Carlton area, Ken Wright, happens to be on the cover of the current issue when we are about a week away from Oregon Wine Month. So it is a terrific tailwind to a promotion that we are running, and I wish I could say we choreographed that, but we absolutely welcome it, and it is not the first time that Oregon has been on the cover of this magazine. Again, this is a magazine that is read around the world, and they are focusing on a region and a winemaker within a region that is far less than 1% of the world's acreage because of the things we're doing here to drive quality and to drive reputation. I'll give you a chance to absorb some of what their writers say about Oregon. Different publication, but the same sentiments expressed by another very highly esteemed global wine critic. And I think to the point that you raised, Representative Gorsuch, and also you, Representative McKeown, about maybe is our business in any way or is our opportunity perhaps in any way approaching saturation? You read things like this, and it's very difficult to say that it is. There is a tremendous runway ahead of us if we are careful and thoughtful about protecting the farms that create the raw material for these wines. This was an interesting recognition. Wine and Spirits magazine, completely divorced now from the Wine Spectator. Wine and Spirits is a trade magazine. They could have picked any grower anywhere in the world as their grower of the year, and they picked one of our great colleagues, Di Crisp, who runs a manages and farms a famous vineyard right near Salem here called Temperance Hill. He's the grower of the year. He won't tell you that. He's pretty humble. But it's a terrific recognition, again, of Oregon. Some other writers, and I'll just draw your attention to the quote in the lower left, which is a wonderful reinforcement. You'll see a distinction after that writer's name, Christy Canterbury. MW means Master of Wine. These are people who have carefully studied and passed a rigorous series of tests to become masters of wine. When they write that about you, it carries weight, it moves markets. And the last couple points that I want to touch on are really around specifically the research and the marketing imperatives of the Wine Board. Again, the industry's funds are allocated by our board of directors for key programs. Out of the industry's own contributed funds, in fact, we just approved a 20% increase to the research budget. And so that's why the fermentation sciences funding, if it were to be approved, would be a multiplier on top of the industry's investment of its own money in research. But these continue to be critical priorities, and we're very fortunate to have our partners at Oregon State and Chemeketa and Southern Oregon University working with us on wine quality. Last thing I want to touch on is a couple of the promotions that you may see in the marketplace, but that are critical to the Wine Board fulfilling its mission of promotion. Again, coming back to our very effective partnership with Travel Oregon, they provided an introduction for us to talk to Alaska Airlines about a program that has been piloted in a couple areas outside Oregon, where the wine consumer comes into the tasting room, can buy a case, and the airline will waive the check baggage fee on that case of wine for that consumer going home. It's another reinforcement of what I talked about earlier, where while getting to market through distributors can be difficult in some cases for wineries, driving direct to consumer and tasting room sales is important. This program is a part of that strategy. We're also the one and only state that Alaska does this with, where all airports in the state served by Alaska participate. Washington and California do not have statewide. What's great about this is it works as well out of the Medford Airport as it does out of the Walla Walla Airport, where people buy our wines in Milton Freewater, and of course Portland and in Redmond, Oregon. I'm sorry, Eugene. Another critical program within our marketing arsenal is acknowledging the restaurants. We have a program called the A-List Awards, where the restaurants that are most effective at evangelizing for Oregon wines are recognized and promoted. Again, restaurants are absolutely essential. That is a place where oftentimes the consumer will ask his or her server for advice about a wine to go with what they've just ordered. It's a great place to romance the Oregon story and to talk a little bit about the wines that that restaurant's focused on. I have to put in a plug for Oregon Wine Month starting in about 10 days. It'll run the entire month of May. And our objective is to raise in a significant way the awareness of the great contributions and the great wines that are being made here in Oregon to Oregonians. You'll see a significantly expanded media outreach, letting people know about Oregon wines, about Oregon wine programs, about tasting room opportunities to meet winemakers and attend key tastings in various areas around the state. We've spent the last few months educating all the distributors in the Northwest about this, all the key grocery chains and the restaurants about this program. You'll be seeing a significantly expanded public profile through advertising, announcing Wine Month, and some of the promotions that go with it. But it's a very, very important part of our program. It gives us a great chance to focus all the energy that revolves around our business. Some of the magazine ads you'll be seeing will feature some of our pioneers. David and Diana Lett on the left, Richard Summers on the right from the Hillcrest Vineyard down in Roseburg. Richard on the right was the person who planted the first Pinot Noir in Oregon in 1961. David and Diana Lett on the left planted the first Willamette Valley Pinot Noir 50 years ago this year. Very important milestone. That's one of the reasons they're acknowledged. And we use that as a reason to talk a little bit about some of the innovation that has taken place since they planted those vineyards. So that concludes what we were going to, I'm sure you're relieved to hear that. That concludes what we were going to share with you on the Oregon Wine Board. If there were any last-minute questions, happy to take them. Otherwise, we'd like to turn to an update from the Oregon Wine Growers Association, our sister agency.
I know Representative Barreto has something.
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In another committee that I sit on, there was discussion of $15 an hour minimum wage and a lot of testimony from the ag industry there, how that would adversely affect them. How would it affect the wine industry?
You know, it's a great question, Representative Barreto, and it certainly does depend on who you talk to. There are a couple of issues that are embedded within there that might not be widely known. One of the most important is that a number of our wine grape growers access their labor pool through independent contractors who clear those workers, deliver them to the work site. That would be a cost that is a percentage of whatever increase would come to the minimum wage, would happen to the minimum wage. So while the wage itself increase is significant for some of our farmers, there's also the hidden cost of some of the contractors that you don't always capture when you just think about the minimum wage. Candidly, our industry is split on this. It is a very difficult issue, and it does hinge on the timing of the increments and the extent of the increments. There are some profound labor dynamics that affect the wine business. I mentioned just a little bit ago about the what might not be widely known, which is the heavy reliance on skilled agricultural labor in these vineyards. When your crop yields are so low, there is very little margin for mistake. Allowing untrained workers to go in there and start leaf thinning or shoot thinning or crop thinning or pruning is a tremendous risk that many farmers do not want to incur. Therefore, skilled agricultural labor is vital to the quality statements that we've been talking about. Many of our growers are already paying above the state's minimum wage, which is the second highest in the country as we sit today. Many of our growers are paying above that minimum wage. We are going to be talking to our industry and to our board over the next several weeks to get their input on this, but it is almost split right down the middle. Many people recognize that they want and need to support the workers who support our industry. But again, as I've said, this is an industry largely driven by mid-sized to smaller family farms who will feel that impact directly and immediately. And it is not a trivial issue. It is deeply split. Deeply held beliefs on both sides of that issue. But again, I have to underscore, many of our growers are already paying above the minimum wage.
Additional questions or comments?
Anything you want to add to that?
Tom, thank you so very, very much.
Certainly. Thank you again for the invitation. And I want to turn now, if you'll indulge us, to my sister organization, the Oregon Wine Growers Association. Again, I mentioned that there's a special interrelationship between the Wine Board, which is tax-funded, but now we're going to talk a little bit about the Oregon Wine Growers Association and a couple of issues that we are working on directly relevant to our industry and to this committee's charter. And I'll ask Doug Tunnell and Jana McCamey to state those issues.
Good morning, Chair Witt, members of the committee. My name is Jana McCamey, and I'm the Government Affairs Director with the Oregon Wine Growers Association. As Tom mentioned, we have two organizations that work for the wine industry here in the state. The Oregon Wine Growers Association is a voluntary membership dues-funded trade association. We have both winery and vineyard members, and we work on a variety of issues for both our growers and wineries. Tom was talking about all of the positive momentum within the industry, and we We see those opportunities. We also, you know, see some challenges ahead, and it's the role of the Oregon Wine Growers Association to be looking out over the horizon, monitoring issues and developing industry responses as our growers and wineries are heads down managing their businesses, growing the quality grapes and making the quality wines that drive the economic numbers that we were talking about earlier. I've put up here what our organization does and our mission statement. We are really looking out for the sustainability of the industry economically, we are represented here in Salem by Dan Jarman, Ellen Miller, Tess Melio, and Dale Penn of CFM Strategic Communications. The wine business is a complex business, as Tom mentioned, and since we work both with vineyards and wineries, we are helping them manage the complex regulatory environment both on the farming side and on the alcohol industry side. It's a highly regulated business, so it is complex, and I'm sure Doug can reinforce this. There are a lot of issues that our growers and wineries are trying to comply with in terms of regulations, in terms of trying to get enough workers out to the vineyards during harvest time. So it's really the role of the Oregon Wine Growers Association to help our hundreds of winery and grower members better manage their businesses. We work both at the state level and at the national level. We just returned from an outreach trip to Washington, D.C. last week, where we met with the Oregon congressional delegation out there and hosted a wine tasting to raise awareness about Oregon wines among critical staff, let's say with the agriculture committees out there and the finance and ways and means committees, to make sure that they know the wine industry exists in Oregon, because some folks outside of Oregon don't realize that, and to experience Oregon and hopefully bring some of them out here as tourists. One issue that has been of concern to our industry for many decades really is the issue of herbicide drift. And I know this is an issue that has been considered in this committee more broadly, and we wanted to take the opportunity between Doug Tunnell and myself just to give a bit of background about this issue and to talk about some of the work that we're undertaking with the Oregon Department of Ag and a broad group of stakeholders in the agriculture community to raise awareness about this issue and to work proactively and collectively to try to minimize the impact of herbicide drift on Oregon's vineyards. Doug has some pictures, but if you saw the picture before of David and Diana Lett, who planted the first Pinot Noir in the Willamette Valley, the initial plantings were actually impacted by 2,4-D spraying back in the 1960s. And also shown here is a communication from the Oregon Department of Ag from 1999 warning about the sensitivity of wine grapes to phenoxy herbicide. So this is not something that is a new issue. It's something that wine industries in California and Washington and elsewhere around the world have dealt with. So this certainly isn't something new for the wine industry globally, but also here in Oregon. One thing to really note is that wine grapes are extremely sensitive. You know, it can take concentrations of 100 times below what's recommended on the label to cause injury in grapevines. And the detection levels that are used in a lot of labs, a far less amount of an herbicide, a phenoxy herbicide, can cause damage in grapevines. And this can affect the vigor of those grapevines, you know, from 1 to 3 years. If it's a really catastrophic case, then those vineyards would possibly need to be torn out and replanted. There is a premium in the wine industry for grapevines that have been planted for long, you know, have been in the ground for a long period of time and decades. So it's not something that is an easy solution just to replant, because it takes many years for those grapevines to produce the grapes and to establish the quality that Tom was mentioning earlier. Further complicating the issue is that there are a few different forms of drift. I know you've had presentations from ODE and other groups earlier in this committee, but there is the spray droplets that can drift from the application, but then there's also the volatilization and vapor drift, and the phenoxy herbicides, if they're ester formulations, even days or weeks after the application, can be pulled up into the air and dropped even miles away. So it makes it very difficult to determine the source and where it's coming from. So it just lends complexity to the issue. You have very sensitive grapevines and the ability of these ester formulations to drift miles. I wanted to note that for wine grapes, the critical time is bud break, which has traditionally been around the 1st of April, but we've seen an early bud break this year. So we say kind of the mid-March to October timeframe, so throughout the growing season, but they're particularly susceptible in the mid-March through June time period. Also wanted to emphasize that it is an extensive issue within the industry. It's very difficult because of the low detection levels that can cause damage, to get good analysis from the Oregon Department of Agriculture complaints and lab. But the Oregon State University did an internal survey for our industry in 2010. And of those surveyed, as you can see from this, about two-thirds have seen some impacts in vineyards, with 73% of those happening every few years, and a little over a quarter seeing some impacts yearly. And the next point is talking about the actual economic impact of the damage. Tom mentioned that the wine industry is a value-added industry, and so you have the farm gate value of the crop, but then you have the value-added nature of the end product, which is the branded bottle of wine that's sold to the consumers. And so we estimate between $13,000 and $50,000 and up per acre if the grapes cannot be processed. So we have brought this issue to the Oregon Department of Ag. It was when one of our board members was testifying to your committee a few years ago in a similar setting about the wine business, and had raised a few issues that are on our minds. And so the Oregon Department of Ag convened a stakeholder work group in January 2014. And we have been working within this group to talk about some solutions to this issue for our industry. And it includes a broad swath of agricultural interests and the Oregonians for Food and Shelter, but also the Oregon Department of Transportation. And we've really been focusing on an education and outreach strategy, which would raise awareness within different agricultural communities, among homeowners, which are a very difficult community to reach, but to really promote the neighbor-to-neighbor communication and see if we can get at this issue in education and outreach. So this is the list of groups that the Oregon Wine Growers Association has met with and worked with to try to share some joint communications about grapevine sensitivity to phenoxies. I wish I could have put a picture up here, but for instance, Wilco, they've developed shelf talkers that they've put up in their aisles at their stores to alert consumers, not specifically about wine grapes, but about application of pesticides, to make sure to read the label, to check weather conditions, whatnot. So we've seen some good results out of this these discussions. In terms of our education within our own industry, we've taken opportunities at our big events, such as the Oregon Wine Symposium, which has 1,500 participants, to really urge our growers to reach out to their neighbors, to be sharing this information about where the vineyards are planted and the susceptibility to certain herbicides. And I put here for information fence signs that we made available to our growers to put up along their fence lines to alert neighbors to the issue. Doug, why don't I turn over to you at this point, if you would like. Doug, to now one of our board members, he is really the expert on this issue, and I want to give him an opportunity to talk about this as well. So I'm going to pass it over, and then we would be open to any questions that you have.
Thank you very much. My name is Doug Tunnell, and 25 years ago next month, I started planting a vineyard on a 40-acre farm in Yamhill County. And on that farm, my wife and I still live, and I make wine there every year. And in fact, as Tom was describing the average Oregon winery, we fall pretty much right in the middle, 71% under 5,000 cases. We are part of that 64% that's in the Willamette Valley, and 57% growing Pinot Noir. That's us, basically. So I'm quite happy to be able to answer any questions with regard to any of those areas, because it's something that we live in and we do every day. But specifically about spray drift, this is an issue that goes well beyond the figures and the facts and the science in rural Oregon, and especially around vineyards. What I'm driving at is it's an issue between neighbors and farmers, and it is a very difficult one when someone is damaged by a spray drift incident. I had a conversation with a grower just yesterday in which he was describing he had been damaged last year, two of his sites, and he was convinced that one of the neighbors with whom he does not get along was at fault. He ran tests in a private lab on that neighbor's grass from the grass seed field, and he discovered that there was no sign of any herbicide on that grass that would have done damage to his grapes. That, in fact, it had drifted clearly from someplace far afield from his vineyard. And yet, there's all this air of suspicion, an air of ill will, an air of anger in many cases, because we're talking about very serious financial loss in many cases. One grower that I profiled last year had about 10 acres of grapes that were damaged to some degree or another by herbicide drift in 2014, actually a year ago this month, April of 2014. He was very generous and shared with me what he thinks the financial impact was for his business. And he, like my wife and I, he is a mom-and-pop operation. He grows grapes and sells some of those grapes as a commodity to other winemakers, and they make some wine on their own. So some of those grapes that he lost have a certain value as a commodity. Others have a much greater value as a value-added product. He estimates that in that 10 acres last year, they lost about $50,000. And that's actually, I think, a fairly conservative estimate, given what we've assembled, putting together other figures from other growers and other damage. Now, that's only based on what he lost in 2014. There is science that shows that not only if there is damage in year X, is there loss in year X, there will also be an impact on crop yield in the following year. And so you're looking at a loss that has yet to be calculated, because this is that year we don't have that crop on the vine yet, and that grower is just waiting to see how big the hammer's going to be for him in 2015 on those acres. And when I spoke to him, I wish I could bring him to you, because it's such an emotional thing for him. He just said, it just makes me sick. I mean, he's a lifelong farmer. We're talking about someone who is a very experienced farmer, has been growing grapes, in fact, was the first vineyard manager for the Irie Vineyard, of the slide you saw of David Lett's vineyard. So as a very young man, 25 years ago, 50 years ago almost, he was beginning to grow grapes. So it's a very serious issue, and one that I can't really emphasize the importance of for us enough. We take great heart right now, because this is the time, this month and next month, or when we will begin to see whether all of the efforts that have led up to today, with all of the efforts of the Oregon Wine Growers Association, of JANA's efforts, of all of our outreach efforts, are going to really solve the problem to some significant degree. And I'm afraid that yesterday I heard my first report of a damage incident to about 5 acres of grapes. I don't know very many details. The owners haven't yet reported it. They're trying to sort out who did it and whether or not to report it to the Department of Agriculture. A lot of times these things don't get reported because of various personal reasons. Again, this is a very intimate and a close affair between farmers in our state. And in fact, last year there was an incident in which the nephew of one of the growers was in fact the person who had sprayed a grass seed field nearby. It was a family issue, and that was never reported, but we know that to be the case. So it really touches the fabric of our rural community and of our farms. And it also raises a lot of ire when we as wine grape growers start talking about how sensitive grapevines are. Well, the science is they really are. They are probably the most sensitive crop to herbicides growing in the state. But obviously, you know, grass seed growers who need to use herbicides of some form at some time can often take umbrage at our cries of distress. And then it can very easily devolve into a discussion of, you know, well, we were here first. You guys just came up from California. You know, all of that kind of finger pointing. It's a very personal dynamic. We are the only state in the West that does not have calendar restrictions on the use of these herbicides. There are restrictions that are successfully implemented in California, in Washington State, in Idaho. They've led the way, and for obvious reasons, Washington State, for example, the grape growing industry is right next door to the wheat ranchers, and they've had to come to some kind of accommodation. And a lot of that is neighbor to neighbor. They've had some good success with outreach and understanding and education like we're trying to do right now. But they also have calendar restrictions and some legislation that has been put in place that has helped to protect one crop from another. With that, I welcome any questions. I thank you again for your time, and I'm happy to address that or any of the other issues that you've raised.
Committee members, Representative Frederick.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. What occurs to me is a question regarding the monitoring of how well we monitor what's going on across the state regarding. I mean, I know that you monitor for that certainly the growers monitor for the various diseases that they might encounter, fungi and nematodes and that whole group. But I'm curious about whether you have set up any sort of monitoring system related to the spraying.
We, as the Wine Growers Association, have had a campaign this year that, in sum, is observe, report.
It's educate, communicate, report.
Educate, communicate, report. And it is our own industry-wide effort to try to educate our own members to what does herbicide drift look like? What'll it do to your plants? How does it happen? What should you do if you're affected? And so we've had some success with that, but it's again informal. The Department of Agriculture has a standard procedure for reporting herbicide drift incidents, and they have protocols in which they will investigate those incidents. But one of the things that we are also very supportive of is any effort to support the ODA's lab, because we've found that last year, for instance, how many
17 of 19.
Were there 17, 19 incidents throughout the state that were reported to ODA. Some of those waited 3 to 6 months before the lab results were actually given to the growers. And there are many questions that arise in that time.
Right.
How are those samples being stored? What are the protocols for collecting the samples? There were cases in which there were samples taken from the impacted vineyard and samples taken from a field next door that belongs to a neighbor. But there were also cases in which the inspectors didn't have the permissions necessary to go into the neighboring fields, even though they could see there may have been an herbicide application there at some point. So it's a complex and difficult area. And I think the ODA, their lab, is doing the best they can. But my impression is they're severely understaffed, and I think their instrumentation is also very limited.
That's my follow-up.
Please.
It's that instrumentation that I think is as well as the ability to have monitoring systems, technological monitoring systems.
Yeah.
We have some work that's going on with nanotechnology that's going to allow us to determine what's out there and perhaps report it right in real time rather than having to take samples and bring things in. But we haven't put those things in yet, and I'm just curious about whether you have looked at that or sort of the technical monitoring rather than just, you know, the sampling is problematic because you aren't sure who's taking it, when.
Right.
You know, the time of day can make a huge difference there.
Yeah. I must confess, that's beyond my expertise.
Okay.
I don't know about the cutting edge yet of what's coming. But I did actually, we had a conversation a few weeks ago with a fellow by the name of Dr. Vince Hebert, who's the laboratory research director at Washington State's Food and Environmental Quality Lab. And he's really a significant expert in this whole field. And he said, and I think it's a worthy quote, "Vineyard symptoms from 2,4-D and other synthetic growth regulators will occur well below analytical detection limits. As an environmental chemist who runs a trace level pesticide regulatory lab, I can assure you that wine grapes are a much more sensitive indicator of exposure to plant hormone mimics than what an extraction method or an analytical instrument can detect." So they're showing symptoms to us that seem, according to this expert, to be well beyond what we can measure so far.
Thank you.
Vice Chair McLean.
Well, first of all, I want to acknowledge that this was a really exciting type of an informational gathering on a very, it looks like, a very vibrant industry that's doing a really good job of bringing economic dollars to the state of Oregon, both for the growers and also for the state, with all of your value added. And I really want to appreciate that and celebrate it. But as usual, with any kind of vital industry and an important type of economic development, there's always a list of challenges. And so you've given us one today that is not a new challenge, as we all know, but it's something that we can maybe see a little bit more of a relationship to your farming. And I really was interested. You had a number of 350 feet that you were putting on your signs, and every time you choose a number, right? every time you choose a number, first of all, people want to know, where did that number come from and what's the science behind that number, especially when some of your other comments were that the drift may have come miles. So I was just wondering on those signs, why did you decide on 350 feet?
Well, that's a thank you. It's a very perceptive question because that was a number that was debated long and hard.
Our industry.
within our industry. And, among those of us who helped design the sign. We took some examples from other states, actually, that have dealt with drift issues and that arrived at 350 feet as a kind of baseline for
visual.
For drift. Now, that's not for that incident which occurs in which the ground is sprayed, for example, and then a week later the temperature rises and you have a volatile ester that is created that then drifts. And that's the long-range drift that's equally damaging as the short immediate spray drift.
Okay.
And so that's how we arrived at 350 as kind of a minimum.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of a minimum.
If I could add to that, it was because these signs would be a visual. It would be, you know, when an ODOT crew or a county road crew was driving by, or a farmer, just to, you know, we figured there would have to be a visual line of sight. So that would be kind of a minimum buffer if someone were looking at the sign. But it was certainly debated internally about that number. But it would be sort of a visual line of sight.
Mr. Chair.
Please.
The only other item that I had as I was listening to you, and it looks like it's something that, again, you know, good neighbor policies and education, you know, are the basis of trying to keep all industry and all farming and all, you know, crops having a fair chance and an equal chance to be successful in our state, and how important that is. And variety, you want to have variety in your portfolio. And so I guess I would really be interested eventually on how you think the education program is going that you yourself are trying to put out there, and see what results there are and maybe where there's still gaps.
Yeah, we'd be happy to come back to you. And we, you know, do want to emphasize that we've had great cooperation with a lot of the ag groups in the state. And I know that they're communicating with their members as well. So we'll be doing an assessment after this season as well as we can to see how it's gone. We'd be happy to report that back to you all.
That would be very helpful. Additional questions or comments? I'm not seeing any.
I want to thank each of you so very, very much for your very thoughtful presentation. This has been exceedingly interesting.
Well, thank you again for the invitation and for your patience and your stamina during this 90 minutes.
piece of cake.
Doesn't take much to get us enthused about talking about this business, as I think you've been able to see over the course of our 90 minutes. The wine business is quite unique and distinctive in the state, not just within ag, but within the global economy. It's a particular challenge because several things vector together that make it very challenging. It is at its core agriculture. From there is processing and manufacturing as that raw material is turned into finished goods. There is a profound and powerful multiplier from the tourism and hospitality component of our business. And lastly, sales, marketing, and distribution, getting your wines out into the marketplace. Those four things make the wine business quite unique and gives us a number of challenges. The last thing I might touch on is that a couple years ago, Senator Ron Wyden was speaking to a group of our growers, and he called the Oregon wine business a relentlessly good news story. And, boy, we have just loved that. We turned that into coffee mugs and mouse pads, T-shirts. It's a wonderful assessment. It requires constant vigilance, protection, as you've heard us talk about today. We have an industry that 49 other states around the country want. We have it. We're extremely fortunate. It deserves the attention that we're prepared to give it. Thank you for your attention today. And if there were two things when you mentioned, Chairman Witt,
yes,
things that where we might be helpful, I would underscore two things we've said: full support and endorsement of the fermentation sciences money that this body and others, your colleagues, will be dealing with shortly. And the second thing is a continued expansion of the resources to the ODA, specifically around this spray drift. That those two things will make a significant difference to further propelling this business that is creating such great multipliers around the state. Thank you again for your attention.
Thank you very, very much. It was a very fast 90 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you.
And with that, is there anyone from the public who would care to make a comment this morning on what they've heard? Seeing none, I'm going to close the informational hearing on wine today. Mr. Gallagher, can you tell us coming events for next week?
I can, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Coming events for next week, we have a discussion on permit reform. You may remember Steve Pfeiffer was in when we had the Dogami bills before us, and he's coming back at your invitation to talk a little bit more about permit reform. And on Thursday, thanks to Rep. McEwen's staff, we have a session on pinnipeds coming before us.
Very, very good.
Thank you.
Anything else, committee members, for the good of the order?
Toothpaste seals.
Huh? Yes.
If I may, before it's gaveled closed, I would want to take advantage of Dan Jarman's good advice to extend an invitation to any committee members or your colleagues who would be open to coming out wherever and whenever it is convenient for your schedule to meet with some of our growers and winemakers around the state. We would be happy to facilitate a tour for any of you or your colleagues, and we will be around after if you'd like to talk about that.
Thank you so very much for that very generous offer. It may even be an opportunity to check for quality control while you're out there.
Yes.
So, thank you very much. We are adjourned.
Thank you.